Hi, and welcome to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. Today, Susan and I are going to talk with Justin Brown, Adnan Syed's attorney, both to get an update on the status of his case, as well as to talk to him about a few of the other cases he's been handling.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here. It's been a long time since I've been on Undisclosed. I think it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen you since the hearing, which we've been waiting on for quite a while now.
Yep, it has been almost 6 months since the oral arguments in the Court of Special Appeals. And I don't have a whole lot to report. I am just waiting the same way that everyone else is waiting. I don't have any inside information as to when they're going to issue an opinion. But if I had to guess, I think, you know, it could be this week. They tend to release opinions at the end of the month. And, you know, 6 month point would be an appropriate time. Or if not this month, then I think toward the end of December. I don't have any inside information.
I was wondering if, as we're recording this at about 4 o'clock, and I was wondering if today's opinions might have it, and it would be scrambling to like read it all in like 20 minutes before we record, but no such luck.
Right. I have been told, I would probably get a heads up, you know, a little bit before it actually gets released. So maybe a half hour before it gets posted or something like that, I think is a matter of courtesy. They would probably let me know.
But of course, whatever happens, regardless of that outcome, it's going to be appealed again, most likely. And we'll do this whole thing again next year.
I think that's probably right. But I think that, well, definitely if they rule in favor of the state, we would definitely appeal it without a doubt. If we win and we win in a convincing fashion, they might hesitate before appealing it further.
You think so? I don't know. I feel at this point they're so dug in, they can't really back down.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there are ways in which an opinion could be written to discourage the state from appealing. We'd really have to run the table. It would be an opinion written as I would write it myself, which doesn't usually happen. But, you know, I'm hope springs eternal, and I am hoping that this, you know, we can get on with this and have a new trial. It's been way too long.
Yeah, and as you said, Justin, this is the first time on the podcast we've talked to you for a while. So we sort of covered the oral arguments back in June on the podcast, but what were your general thoughts about how those oral arguments went?
I thought they went very well. What was interesting to me was that obviously the judges were very focused on the alibi issue more than I had anticipated. So to me, and again, I'm viewing things through my optimistic perspective. To me, it looked like, you know, maybe they would reverse the lower court on the alibi issue, which would obviously be fantastic with us. And then sort of the cell phone issue, which is probably more complicated and involves a difficult waiver issue. You know, if they ruled for us on the alibi, it would be plausible that they could just punt on that issue and not even go to it. So, I like the way it went. But then again, I have never been successful at predicting what appellate judges are going to do.
Right. And that gets to the issue that Susan had mentioned, which is appeal to the Court of Appeals of Maryland. And I think this is what you were touching on. And that is the cell tower issue involves this issue of waiver that at least potentially could impact many future cases. And so whichever side wins on that, there's a decent chance that Maryland's highest court would want to hear that. Whereas the alibi issue, whether trial counsel was ineffective based on failing to contact Asia McClain, that's something that the Maryland courts have addressed before, and it wouldn't really be breaking new ground. And so if you win on that issue...
It's almost black letter at this point, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you win on that issue, I mean, even if the state decided we want to appeal, then there's a decent chance that the Court of Appeals, the highest court in Maryland, just wouldn't even hear that appeal, right?
I think you're right. I think that it would be, it's a much more fact-based issue, so that it doesn't, it's not as attractive to appellate courts as the waiver issue is. So, I agree with that. I agree.
And I know we've addressed this before in the show, but how would you say this weight compares to other cases?
It's difficult. You kind of forget about it for a while, and then, but everywhere I go, people ask me, "Hey, what's going on? You know, what's happening with Syed?" And you know, so it's sort of, "Oh yeah, that." And you know, my heart starts beating a little bit faster, and you know, it just it's been a long time, and it's hard to deal with the stress. But throughout the process of this case, I have gotten accustomed to it. So, you know, I just do my thing and try to think about other stuff and, you know, control only what I can control.
And it does feel like it's become a little bit of a political issue now with Theroux entering the race in Baltimore.
That is a little bit unusual that opposing counsel is running for state's attorney. The thing about the state's attorney's race, it's not a very visible race, so you don't hear a whole lot about it or see a whole lot about it. It just kind of, you know, the candidates are out there doing their own thing and trying to raise money and stuff like that. But it's not like there's signs all around town for the state's attorney race right now. So I don't think about that a whole lot either.
There's an issue, though, that is pretty current on your mind. You just tweeted about it today, and that is juvenile life without parole, and I guess in Maryland, this de facto juvenile life without parole. And so in terms of what you're seeing through your own cases and other cases, what is the current status of defendants in Maryland convicted and given life sentences as juveniles of homicide offenses?
So in Maryland, this is the legal argument that defendants are making right now, is that when somebody in Maryland receives a life sentence, essentially they're receiving a sentence of life without parole. And that's because in order for a lifer to be paroled, they need the permission or the approval of the governor, and governors just have not given that, dating back to Paris Glendening, who's a former governor of Maryland, I think from, probably the late 80s, early 90s, sometime around then. He instituted a policy of life means life, and stopped granting parole for these people. And no governor of either party has strayed from that policy. So that while it might be theoretically possible for a juvenile with a life sentence to be paroled, in effect, that just has not happened over decades. And that's the argument that people are making now on behalf of juveniles, is that when a juvenile gets a life sentence, that is the equivalent of a life without parole sentence in the state of Maryland.
Is Maryland the only state that does it that way? It's crazy how they've somehow politically gotten themselves in a circumstance where life is never, ever getting paroled for anyone. I mean, Georgia has plenty of problems there, but there are realistic chances for someone with a life sentence to get paroled. Even it takes 20, 25 years to do so. Whereas in Maryland, you're just there forever.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I'm not aware of any other states that have that political landscape. And it's really bizarre, you know, because we've had Republican governors, we've had Democratic governors, and through all of that change, this policy has remained intact. It's discouraging, because if it were more explicit and if it were part of the law, then those sentences would be unconstitutional, you know, as the Supreme Court has now held. But we're kind of stuck in this in-between area where there's no relief for these people.
I think a while ago, wasn't there talk that they were going to have these resentencing hearings for juveniles? Is that just something that hasn't gotten any real traction, actually implementing that at this point?
I think what it was, if I'm correct, is that they were going to give them parole hearings, but that doesn't mean a whole lot unless, again, the governor is going to agree to it. So they might conduct a hearing, and then the parole board might make a recommendation to the governor. And but, you know, again, unless the governor gives the green light, nothing's going to happen. As of now, the system has not changed, but there are you know, there's litigation underway. I'm not sure the exact status of it, but I believe it's in the Court of Appeals, and it's going to be addressed fairly soon, maybe within the next year.
The holidays are fast approaching, and with Omaha Steaks, you can order gifts for everyone on your list with just the click of a mouse. Now, I can say I've been using Omaha Steaks for over a decade to get gifts for friends and loved ones, and they always tell me how great the food is, and the process is always really easy. And that's because Omaha Steaks offers unique gifts for gourmet food lovers, over 500 gourmet gift ideas, and they're not just steaks. They have poultry, pork, veal, and lamb, and for pescatarians like me, they even have a great assortment of seafood and veggies. And right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings just to my listeners. Listen to everything you'll get for less than $50. 2 filet mignons, 2 top sirloins, 2 boneless pork chops, 4 boneless chicken breasts, 4 kielbasa sausages, 4 burgers, 4 potatoes au gratin, 4 caramel apple tartlets, 1 Omaha Steaks seasoning packet, plus you get 4 additional kielbasa sausages for free. So go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code UA in the search bar, and get a 75% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit.
Have you been following some of the corruption trials or corruption claims going on with the Baltimore Police Department lately? It seems like the past year, it's been one thing after another up there.
Yeah, I have. I represent some of the people who were involved with that case and who were victimized by these police officers. So I've been watching it quite closely.
So one thing I've been wondering is with the videotape evidence, it seems like it was kind of luck that some defense attorneys found the video showing that they are basically staging drug evidence at these scenes. But it was made available to defense attorneys. What was the process there, and why was it kind of like a surprise that these guys found it?
Well, first of all, the video cameras are new to Baltimore. And when you have a case that involves video evidence, you know, there might be 10 police officers involved. So there's an enormous amount of video that should be turned over to defense counsel. I think it's hard for a lot of, you know, a lot of defense attorneys just to go through all that video. And fortunately, you know, the public defender's office was able to do that. And they're the ones, I believe, who found those particular clips where the officers appeared to be planting or reenacting a discovery of evidence, whatever it was. So it was a pretty good find, and I think you just get overwhelmed with massive amounts of video, and it's hard to review everything.
Yeah, I mean, from the videos, it seems like the cops know that they're being, I mean, they turn the cameras on, they know they're being recorded, and they have zero concern with that.
Right. But I'm not aware of in the federal indictment, I don't think any of those were actually videotaped. But it's, you know, more based on witness testimony, some facts that were able to be corroborated. And you know, police officers who for years and years and years, people have known that they were doing this. Defense attorneys have known that they were doing this. I tried a case in Baltimore City Circuit Court against two of these police officers right before they got indicted in the feds. And it was apparent, I think, to everyone in the courtroom, including the jury, that they were not being truthful in their testimony. But yeah, it was just going on and on. And for whatever reason, the system was permitting it. You know, prosecutors continued to use them. judges were believing their stories. In some cases, juries were believing their stories. You know, finally the feds got involved, got their wiretaps up, and these officers are going to receive very long federal sentences.
And the range of misconduct itself is pretty impressive. I mean, you have the officers that are sort of like, you know, planting evidence at crime scenes, and you have officers that are straight up like, I guess mugging's the word. People, they, like the citizens are supposed to be protecting.
Yeah, no, it's pretty shocking. You know, again, you could imagine how the effect that it has when you have police officers interacting with the community in this way. It's so destructive on so many different levels. You know, not only for the individual who is the victim of it, but just the trust of the community. And it's just, you know, you look at the problems that Baltimore is having right now, and things like this just make it worse and worse. It's pretty stunning what's been going on.
So theoretically, if you had a case where your client was charged for drug possession and the officers involved aren't one of the ones that are known to be involved in this sort of corruption racket, is there a way you can bring that up at all before the jury now, or is that still off limits?
I don't think there's a way to get that in. But I will say that if right now you're trying a case in Baltimore City, the jurors are going to be acutely aware of what's going on with the police corruption. So right now there's a very, very low conviction rate in Baltimore City, just because, you know, juries are not convicting people. And I think that erosion of the trust, you know, where you have a police officer taking the witness stand, in some jurisdictions, the jurors are going to believe wholeheartedly what the police officers have to say. But in Baltimore City, jurors just don't believe the police like they do elsewhere. So it's really hard for the state's attorney's office to get convictions. So I think it plays out that way.
Yeah, it seems like a vicious cycle. The convictions are harder to get because the jurors rightfully do not see reasonable doubt based on what the police are saying. So the police have to try and play harder, maybe dirtier, to try and get a conviction.
Right. Their stories. Yeah. The stories almost have to be better and better. The officers claim to have, you know, pulled the car over and in plain view, you know, all the drugs were sitting on the console of the vehicle. And
because that's how people drive around in Baltimore.
Right. Right. You know, then the suspect invited the officers to search his car, and then he, you know, blurted out a confession. And so you get these factual patterns that just look facially suspicious. Yeah, it is a vicious cycle. And we've just got big problems right now in our system.
Yeah, and somewhat adjacent to that, recently we had this verdict in the Sabian Burgess case, $15 million against Baltimore, and it was a case involving some of the same officers involved in Anand's case. What was your reaction to seeing that news, and what have you sort of heard around town about the reaction to this $15 million verdict in this wrongful conviction case?
It's an incredible verdict. It will be interesting to see how it plays out, because certainly the city's going to appeal that. And at the end of the day, Baltimore has I don't know how common it is in other municipalities, but the city is not legally required to indemnify the individual police officers. So the $15 million verdict is a verdict against individual police officers. And that's only as valuable as the extent to which the city is willing to pay that.
Let's check how much overtime they've been working. I'm sure some of them might be able to do it.
Right, right. Well, no, I mean, you know, I have a similar wrongful conviction case that I've been working on. And, you just wonder how much the city can pay, how much they're able to afford. And, you know, I'll be very interested to see how this all winds up.
And are you able to share some of the details of that wrongful conviction case that you're working on?
Yeah, no, it's a person who was arrested and convicted when he was 16 years old. He served 17 years in prison. And he went through, he sort of fully exhausted the legal process. And at some point, I've actually got the document right in front of me now. He obtained a police report that said specifically that an officer had been told by another individual who was on the scene that that individual had shot the person who was killed. So it was a straight up confession by someone who was present at the scene. And this statement, this confession was never turned over to defense counsel. Making matters worse, there was a note put on the statement, like a sticky note saying that essentially that this report is not to be released under any circumstances.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they even like, by the way, this is Brady, we're not handing over. Make sure you don't hand it over.
Yeah, yeah.
How'd you get that, the sticky note? It just came on top, like they produced the note as well?
It's a copy. It's like a Xerox copy of it. So, you know, that you've got the report and then there's like sort of square notes and it's written on those. Oh, yeah. So, but yeah, so, you know, it's a pretty sad case because this kid spent 17 years in prison, went in as a 16-year-old, and you can only imagine how that affects someone's life. Sounds like someone we know, huh?
Yep. And it's been what? So I guess when Sarah Koenig first approached Anon, it was 2014, 2013 even? That's already been 5 years almost since then, and will be before this gets finalized, most likely, if not longer.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's in our legal system, the system is designed to preserve finality, and it goes to such great lengths to do that. And, you know, I think that's really a problem we have with our criminal justice system, that sometimes we forget that maybe the priority should be the pursuit of the truth rather than just upholding convictions for the sake of finality. And it's just so hard to do. And I think, you know, we're seeing it in the Syed case. And, you know, from what I've heard about some of the other cases that you guys have been investigating, you know, it's pervasive. And it's just really, really hard to undo a conviction.
Yeah. It sometimes feels like you can't look at a case file without seeing red flags immediately in half of them. I'm exaggerating a bit, but like it's crazy how like you start, and also again these things run in patterns, so you start looking at one officer who's done this before and you look at more cases they've done and more red flags keep popping up.
Yep. Yeah, you just the more you dig the more likely you are to find something, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and while the courts have been slow, we did have success in the Sean Thomas case, which was the conviction review unit in Philadelphia throwing out his conviction. Do you know, Justin, is there a conviction integrity unit or something of that ilk in Baltimore? And do you know if they've actually had any results one way or the other?
Yeah, there is such a unit in Baltimore City. And there was, I think within the past year, they recognized someone's innocence and did release him from prison. His name is escaping me right now.
Yeah, it's Malcolm Bryant. He passed away less than a year after he got out.
I think that's right.
And that was, and again, so at the press conference for that, they took credit for it. But that Baltimore fought DNA testing for over 5 years in the case. And when it came back and showed it wasn't matched, it kept trying again until finally they're like, well, I guess the DNA is definitely not his. We'll finally give in. And then they act as if they were the ones who like took the ball and ran it, made it happen.
Right. Right. And, you know, again, that's kind of typical of our system, where if the prosecutor says it's so, then it must be right. Whereas, you know, unfortunately, defense attorneys, sometimes our voices are not taken as seriously as prosecutors' voices are. So really, you know, the best way to get something like this overturned is through consent. And, you know, the courts start listening once the prosecutors are on board.
Have you gotten any updates from how the investigation's going these days from the current investigators working on it?
Are you talking about
Anon's case? Yeah.
Yeah, we've been pursuing a few things, and some information has been coming in, and we are continuing to, you know, get ready in the event that there is a trial. So it's probably still a long ways off, but we are moving, and have made some progress, yes.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, anything found now won't be of use unless a trial does happen.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But, you know, you never know how things are going to play out. And whatever path this might go down, you know, good facts are only going to help us. So we will continue to pursue them.
And I hope for a non-sake it doesn't happen, but I kind of really hope to see a trial here secretly. It'd be amazing.
That would be something, wouldn't it? And again, you know, I shudder to think of sort of the additional delay that would cause.
Yeah, it'd be terrible, but it would be a spectacle.
Yeah. No. I would very much look forward to that.
What are the current cases you've got before the court? So on the same day that, or the same weekend, week that you had the arguments in Anand's case, you were also in Annapolis for another case.
Yeah. That was a case which I thought we had a very, very strong issue. And we lost that appeal. We have filed a petition for writ of certiorari. And so I'm also kind of eagerly awaiting that because I do think we have a good chance of getting to the Court of Appeals on that case. It's called State versus Tavon Fullwood. You know, again, a very, very strong issue. But, you know, it just got denied. We lost. And but I still hold out some hope for that.
Yeah. And I don't want to bring up any cases that you can't talk about right now. But the one you had where the prison snitch was set up, basically, is that one you can talk about?
Yeah, that's in public right now. We filed a federal habeas on behalf of our client who was given a very long sentence for allegedly conspiring to murder his wife. The entire evidence against him was a jailhouse snitch. It was just highly, highly dubious. That was a case where I actually thought, perhaps naively, that the attorney general's office would agree with us that this person should be released from prison immediately. But they opposed our habeas motion, and everything's been filed with U.S. District Court, and we are eagerly awaiting on any action by the judge. Hopefully there will be a hearing.
That was another one of those cases you showed to me, and I was kind of disheartened because there's another case I've been looking at. It's pretty absurd as well. And you sometimes feel like it's so absurd that surely prosecutor has to see it. But you showed me that filing, I'm like, guess not.
Right. What's going on with that case? Are you talking Baltimore County?
Yeah, we're still looking at it, and hopefully we'll be pursuing it next year.
Good. Yeah, that one's pretty egregious. And if I recall, that inmate still has yet to file his post-conviction.
Yeah, still don't believe that's happened yet.
Okay. You know, I get so many cases where, you know, people have lost a post-conviction and there's just nothing left for them to do. They're timed out of a federal habeas and, you know, just very few options.
Mm-hmm. How often do you encounter the snitch cases like this, where it's just a pretty preposterous jailhouse witness saying, oh, they confessed to me and told me everything? I haven't seen that many, but I don't know if you've encountered more.
Not that many. I have always viewed that as sort of the worst kind of evidence that there is. You know, maybe I guess there's worse evidence, you know, maybe like bite mark or, you know, shoe print evidence and things like that.
Lead analysis.
Yeah. Lead batch analysis. Right. But yeah, I mean, jailhouse snitches are notoriously the worst. And I think in more sophisticated prosecutors are able to see right through that. But yeah, it persists. It's definitely a category of its own and needs to be viewed with special skepticism.
Are there any other cases that you can talk about that are ongoing right now?
I've got one interesting case is a guy who committed a burglary, or he allegedly committed a burglary. He was convicted of it at trial. So even assuming he did commit it, and then he fled, and there was a pursuit of him, and a gun went off, but no one was shot, and, you know, who knows how the gun went off. And he received a life sentence for that. Nobody was hurt. It was a...
How?
He had three prior convictions for burglary. So it was an old Maryland three strikes law where they considered burglary to be a crime of violence. So if you were then convicted of a fourth crime of violence, you received a mandatory life sentence. So I represent this guy who he's served over 30 years in prison for burglary. And right now we're trying to get him out. He's been a, you know, model prisoner. I mean, it's just so, it's so ridiculous. It shocks the conscience. And I am sincerely hoping that the prosecutor's office is going to see it the same way that I do.
Just the warehousing of prisoners in Maryland that have no realistic chance of ever getting out for crimes of, you know, some are obviously the most serious murder, but not even murder. It sounds like for some of these guys.
Yeah, I think there were about three or four defendants who were sentenced under this old law for prior burglaries. And one of them got his sentence commuted by the governor. And I think in addition to my client, there might be like one other person in the system who's serving a life sentence under similar conditions.
Okay, so it's not at least rampant that's happening.
No. I mean, you know, it takes sort of some really bad strokes of luck. But you know, one person is enough. Just rotting in prison. You know, 30 years, it's more than, you know, people serve on most murders.
Yeah. And it's probably over-optimistic of me, but part of me hopes that sort of the natural experiment that the Youngers have presented might help contribute to sort of reduced incarceration. That's the case where sort of a longstanding sentencing law got overturned, which meant that, I think, 150 maybe, people serving life sentences were released. All of them, what, their 50s, 60s, 70s?
Yeah. I forget what the year cutoff was, but there
was 200 actually.
And some of those cases are still being litigated. You know, it kind of depended on the nature of the conviction. I actually represented one of them, and we got his conviction overturned. But then the state was determined to pursue new charges against him or to retry the old case against him because he had been convicted of murdering a police officer. So, you know, they were taking it more seriously than they would at another murder, which I guess it makes some sense to some people. But nonetheless, he eventually ended up pleading guilty and has to serve what will likely be a few more years, and then he'll be released.
Mm-hmm. I had not checked in the past few months, but the stats were pretty amazing. And these are all, you know, older guys. They've been locked up for most of their lives. And the amount of recidivism is very low. It seemed like a couple of small parole violations, but to the extent I've seen, that was basically it. And you've got to wonder, we've got, probably tens of thousands of people like that locked up in this country. Millions and millions of dollars spent on it. And to what end?
Right. No, absolutely. And yeah, these guys have been doing very well. I just heard about there's a group that that meets in Baltimore. Like, I think it's called First Mondays, where all these guys who have served really long sentences kind of get together, and a lot of really innovative programs that are working with them and good support. And yeah, just it makes no sense to warehouse people. Doesn't do our communities any good, and people come out a lot worse than they were when they went in, oftentimes.
So what are your thoughts on the current Department of Justice situation?
we have a very interesting perspective because I've practiced in federal court for a long time, and Rod Rosenstein has run the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore forever. And I've known him for a while. I don't know him well, but, you know, known him. And so, it's pretty interesting to see him at the center of the storm, in this very, very difficult position. But yeah, it's, It is what it is. It's just, it's insane.
The Sessions is, I mean, he's probably the most competent one in that bunch, and he's, you know, making the most of his time there.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the policies that he has implemented are very real, and they're having very real effects. You know, federal prosecutors are, it's already been a very severe sentencing scheme, as you know, in federal court. But, you know, now they have to, if there's a guilty plea, it's got to be to the lead charge, and they're favoring mandatory drug sentences. You know, there are real effects to it that are being played out in the federal courts. You know, not as a result of a change in law, but as a change in policy that's implemented by Jeff Sessions.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, as far as I can tell, I mean, it doesn't seem like white collar crime's really been definitely not ramped up at all there. This enforcement push from Sessions is definitely focused on sort of the anything that's not white financial crime.
Right, right. And again, you know, the easiest people to get convictions against are poor people who don't have any power and don't have the money to hire fancy lawyers. You know, it's like sometimes it's like shooting fish in a barrel. I think it's been around here because we're in Baltimore City. They're just traditionally a large part of that office is devoted to, you know, more traditionally state type of crimes, drugs and guns and things like that.
Well, in light of the Burgess case, are you looking at doing more sort of civil side, possibly representing sort of financial suits?
I think it's, you know, it's something that I've done some of these in the past, and I think with a criminal practice, it sort of, I wouldn't say dovetails, but it's possible to do both. And I think that in some ways the practices can complement each other. Also, you know, doing sort of wrongful convictions, civil suits against the police. I think it's consistent with a criminal defense practice. So
yeah, Kathleen Zellner seems to have hit that sweet spot there.
Right, right. No, she's a good example of someone who does that. Both of them. And, I think she's got a good model, and certainly she's had a lot of success doing it.
Well, I wish I could talk to you more about the Syed case and all the updates that happened there, but that'll have to wait a bit longer.
Yeah, yeah. There's not a whole lot I can talk about.
It's interesting, though. I can say that much. Is there anything else you wanted to, any parting thoughts or any issues you wanted to bring up?
Well, all the support for Adnan and for our efforts continues to be visible, and everywhere I go, people are encouraging and supportive. And so for the fans out there and the supporters, I can't say how much we appreciate that. It's really uplifting. And this has been a tough journey, but it's good to have everyone supporting us.
And even 3 years onwards, people still care.
People still care, yeah. I saw an interesting thread on Twitter where someone was saying, hey, is that book that Rabia wrote, is that worth checking out? And it's still relevant. And so there's a lot of stuff out there. And yeah, it's been a wild ride.
Yeah.
And there's more to go.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And I definitely look forward to getting you back on once we win the appeals. Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. All right. Thanks a lot, Susan. Take it easy.
Bye, Justin.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. Next Monday, Rabia, Susan, and I will be back covering a brand new case, the Terrence Lewis case involving a murder in West Philadelphia in 1996. I'd like to thank the following people. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production. Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Talhan, our executive producer. I'd like to thank our sponsor for today, Omaha Steaks. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.